Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good day and welcome to the Vori Sater Seymour and Pease Healthcare Reform Preparing for Change conference call. Thank you for joining us. Just a reminder, today's call is being recorded. Please note that there will be a question and answer session at the end of today's call. Instructions on how to ask a question will be given at that time. At this time, for opening remarks and introductions, I'd like to turn the call over to Tony Siriaco with Vori Sater Seymour and Pease. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Melissa. Good afternoon to everyone. Thank you for joining us for our third teleseminar. Today we're going to try something a little bit different than we've done in the first two for those of you who have been with us. We're going to try to apply some real-life situations to the theory, and we're going to have some case studies of some examples. We're also going to provide you with an update on guidance. We've learned some informal stuff today on grandfathering, which we're going to share with you. And finally, we're going to give you some early thoughts on communications with your employees. And as Melissa said, for the first time in our teleconferences, we're going to have some time at the end for some questions and answers. So any questions that you have regarding healthcare reform, they don't have to be limited to today's presentations. Feel free to ask them, and Melissa will give you the instructions when the time comes. So with that, why don't we turn to slide number two, which is talking about guidance. And officially, we are still waiting for guidance with respect to grandfathering. We do know that changes to comply with the health reform laws will not jeopardize grandfathering. But we do have, and actually received this today, it's one of those things that we got right before the call, some informal information regarding what might be floating out there regarding grandfathering. So I'm going to turn the program over to my colleague, Jennifer Dunsizer, to talk a little bit about that.
Thanks, Tony. We saw some chatter in various web postings earlier today describing a version of the proposed regulations, or the regulations that they believe will be proposed on the grandfathered status that are floating around in D.C. I had the opportunity to speak with someone who's actually read the or has a copy of that draft regulation, and his takeaway was that there are some things in it that are bad, and there are some things in it that aren't quite as bad as they could have been. Wasn't quite saying that there's some stuff that's good. He did say that, you know, good might be a relative opinion, and that it wasn't going to be, some things aren't going to be quite as bad as they otherwise would be. The draft that's being circulated is still subject to a fairly substantial amount of internal debate within the regulatory agencies, so it's a little too early to be able to actually give you any definition as to what the interpretations that are likely to be taken in the regulations are, but they're at least at the point where they are actually starting to leak the draft to certain individuals for preliminary feedback on, you know, is this something that's going to be absolutely earth-shattering, or is it in the category of, well, it's not the way we would like it, but we'll live with it. So all that's a relatively long-winded statement for there is a draft that is circulating that take some positions that will not be as happy as we might want it to be as the employer community having to administer these, but we still don't actually have drafts to be able to comment on. Tony?
Great. Thanks, Jen. And as all of you know, one of the things we are concerned about with grandfathering is what types of changes can we make to our plans with regard to everyday kinds of things like deductibles and co-pays and who's eligible and not blow the grandfathering. So those are the kinds of things that we're, as Jen was saying, bad and not as bad. So that's the kind of thing we're looking for, to see if the rules are going to be lenient or stringent. And we're going to try to obtain, and I think we actually will obtain, yet today, a copy of what's floating around. And when we have some real guidance, and as Jen pointed out, this is at this time only preliminary, we'll continue to post things on our website when we have some guidance that will be helpful to our to all of you. We have also some additional information for those of you that are subject to collective bargaining agreements. Again, this is on the level of informal, a government official speaking on a conference call. So we don't know if this is going to get into the official regulations when the time comes out. But generally, when new laws are passed, plans that are subject to collective bargaining agreements are not subject to the new laws until the existing collective bargaining agreement expires. So if you're subject to an agreement that does not expire until 2012, you would not be subject to the new rule. That's the general rule. What we're hearing, at least in this informal statement, was that may not be the rule with respect to health care reform. So even if you have a collective bargaining agreement that is going to expire past the beginning of your plan year that begins after September 2010, you still may have to comply at the beginning of your 2011 plan year. So again, we'll keep an eye on all of that and get you as much information and as soon as possible with respect to grandfathering, because we know that is a very important issue to all of you. Now with that, we'll move on to slide number 3 and get into our case studies. We're going to jump ahead a little bit. In some of our other seminars, we've really focused on the things that are going to come into play in 2011, 2012. As all of you know that have been following health care reform, the real show starts in 2014. And the whole world of health care changes at that time. We have enhanced Medicaid eligibility, so people at a higher level of income will be eligible for Medicaid. The exchanges that are out there or supposed to be out there will be up and running in each state, where individuals and small groups can purchase insurance policies. There'll be penalties imposed on individuals who do not purchase health insurance. Free choice vouchers will be available to individuals who have coverage from their employer. And there'll be potential penalties on large employers. And remember, for purposes of the penalty, large employer is 50 or more for those who either do not provide insurance or do not provide enough of a subsidy for the insurance. So in order to jump ahead to 2014 and give you a feel for what your life might be at that point, dealing with the world of subsidies and vouchers, we've created some examples here. And I'm going to turn it over to Jen to kind of set the stage before we get into the examples.
Thanks, Tony. I think it's helpful, first of all, for us to lay a little bit of the groundwork, which is, again, remember that someone can be eligible for a subsidy if their income is between 100% of the federal poverty level and 400% of the federal poverty level, and the contribution that they are required to make for health care or for the health insurance, the employee share of the premium cost, is greater than 9.5% of their household income. And someone would be eligible for a voucher if their household income is less than 400% of the federal poverty level, and their premium contribution would be between 8% and 9.8% of the federal poverty level, or I'm sorry, of their household income. So the first slide that we've given you on slide 4 is a grid that shows what 100% of the federal poverty level is, what 400% of the federal poverty level would be, and what 133% of the federal poverty level would be. We've given you, again, that 133% because that's going to be the Medicare eligibility or Medicaid eligibility threshold. And one of the things that's interesting as you look at this slide is that you can have someone that has a $250,000 household income that's still eligible for, or potentially eligible for, a voucher or a subsidy if their household income or household number of family members would qualify them for a reality TV show. If you've got 15 people in your household, you can be eligible with $250,000 in household income. Okay, moving to slide 5, we've given you some different employee contribution levels for a single employee with only one person in their household. What kinds of income levels would be needed to be eligible for a voucher or a subsidy? And looking at this slide, you can see that someone that has an individual cannot be eligible for a subsidy at the employee as a single individual household if the premium that's charged is much less than the $1,500 threshold. Because at $1,000, 9.5% of the household income to be $1,000 is going to be more than 9.5% of your household income. So you're not going, I'm sorry, less than 9.5% of your household income. So you're not going to be able to be eligible within that. You're going to be less than 100% of the federal poverty level, and so you're not going to be eligible to participate. Looking at the voucher side, because you've got that it's for only individuals who have a household income less than 400% of the federal poverty level, you can see that an individual whose premium cost for coverage would be $4,500 would not be eligible because their compensation to be within that 8% to 9.8% band would be above the 400% of the federal poverty level. At the very low employee contribution levels, you're going to not be, you're going to have technical eligibility at the $1 contribution level on an annual basis. You technically are going to have eligibility, but I don't know anybody that's going to have income between the $10 and $12 and 50 cent range that would be eligible. So that gives you sort of an overview from an individual level. Looking at a family of four, it's basically the same analysis. The only thing that's changing is the premium contribution and the income thresholds that are impacted by that family of four status. And basically, a family of four ends up being basically double the single threshold. Okay, moving to slide 7. You can see we've given you some examples of what does qualifying for the subsidy mean. And here we've given what the employee premium cost would be to buy insurance on the exchange, again, given two different scenarios, a single individual and a family of four. And at various income thresholds, a single person with a household income of that of $14,404, which is for a single person right at that 133% of the federal poverty level. So they'd be eligible for Medicaid. That individual would have to pay only $432 annually to buy coverage on the exchange. If your premium cost would be greater than $432 a year, then an individual would be likely to buy the coverage on the exchange rather than paying your premium cost because they can buy it cheaper on the exchange. On the other hand, if you charge less than $432, they're going to pick up your coverage because your coverage is cheaper. And so an employer can look at these premium contribution levels and figure out whether an eligible employee is likely to buy coverage on the exchange or instead pick up the employer's plan. Okay, moving to slide 8, we've given you an illustration of what the voucher amount would be. And here, a voucher amount is just the difference between what you would charge the employee for coverage and what the annualized COBRA premium would be for that coverage. And that's the voucher amount. We still don't actually have guidance on whether it's the best subsidy overall or just the best subsidy available to that employee. But this gives you a sense of what voucher amounts would look like. And with that, I'm going to turn it back to Tony.
Thanks, Jen. As all of you can see, the interplay between subsidies and vouchers can become quite complex, dealing with all the numbers, the poverty level, the percentages of income, and those things. So what we thought would be very helpful to kind of guide you through that maze of numbers is to set up some examples. So we've set up 14 examples that we're going to walk through with different individuals, different family sizes, different premiums, to give you a feel for when that individual would be eligible for a subsidy or a voucher or in some limited circumstances, both. So if you look on slide 9, this kind of sets the stage for our examples. We're going to assume 3 different employers, and we've named them average company. An average company charges their employees for single coverage about $200 a month or $2,500 per year. And for family coverage, they charge about $400 a month or about $5,000 per year. Our second employer we've dubbed low employee cost because they charge for their single coverage about less than $100 per month, so only about $1,000 per year. And our third employer we've dubbed high employee cost because that employer charges for single coverage about $400 per month or $5,000 per year, and about, for family coverage, exactly $1,000 per month or $12,000 per year. So those are our 3 employers in the scenario, and we're going to have 14 different employees. 9 of those 14 employees will be employed by average company. And if you look on slide 10, those are Allen Adams through Ellen Edge. Now, the numbers next to their names, if you look, Ellen is number 5, and then you look at Isabella Gregg, number 10, those numbers coincide with the number of the example number that we're going to deal with them. So we have 5 individuals for average company that have single coverage and 4 individuals that have family coverage. If you move to slide 11, we have 1 individual who works for low employee cost company, and she will be receiving single coverage. And then finally, 4 employees that work for high employee cost company, 3 of which are single, and 1 is family. So again, we're going to use these examples to kind of give you a feel for where the numbers will shake out. So with that, let's move to case study number 1, which is slide number 12. And Jen, here we've got Allen Adams. He works for average company, and he has single coverage, and he has household income of about $10,000. How's everything work for him?
Certainly. Again, remember that to be eligible for a subsidy, your income has to be between 100% and 400% of the federal poverty level. So those are 2 of the last 3 lines on the slide. And then your premium as a percentage of your household income has to be more than 9.5% of your household income. And that's the last line on the slide. And to be eligible for a subsidy, your income has to be less than that 400% of the federal poverty level number. I'm sorry, to be eligible for a voucher, you have to be less than 400% of the federal poverty level. And that percentage of the premium as a percentage of your household income has to be between 8% and 9.5%, or 9.8%. So as you look at Allen, Allen isn't going to qualify for a voucher or a subsidy because although the premium's more than 9.5% of his household income, his compensation is below that 100% threshold. And so, although it's below the 100% threshold, which means he could theoretically be eligible for a voucher, he's not eligible for a voucher because his household, his percentage of household income isn't between that 8% and 9.8% band. So he's not eligible for the subsidy because his income's too low, and he's not eligible for a voucher because the percent of premium is above the 9.5%. So Alan isn't eligible for either a voucher or a subsidy.
Okay, well, let's change it a little bit, Jen. We'll go to Brian Brown on slide 13. He works for the same company. He's single, and he makes $1,000 more than Alan. Does that change anything?
It does, because, again, his premium as a percentage of household income is still above 9.5%, but now his income is within that magic band of 100% and 400% of the federal poverty level, and therefore he's going to be eligible for a subsidy. He's still not eligible for a voucher because it's not under the 9.8%.
So let's change it up just a little. Case study number 3, which is on slide 14. Charlie, also employed by Average Company, also single coverage, but he makes about 2.5 times more than Alan and Brian. What's his situation?
Charlie is actually going to be eligible to pick whether he wants a voucher or the subsidy. Because the premium as a percentage of his household income is 9.62%, he is going to be, it's above the 9.5%, and his income is in that band between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty level, so he's going to be eligible for the subsidy, and it's also between 8% and the 9.8% of the federal poverty level, or I'm sorry, the premium as a percentage of household income is between that 8% and 9.8%, so he's going to be eligible for a voucher. Now, if you flip back to the slide number 7 for the question of what would the premium cost have to be for him to be eligible for, or to what would he have to pay for a voucher, he would be his premium, I'm sorry, what would he have to pay to buy subsidized coverage on the exchange? His subsidized premium cost is actually going to be less than $2,193, and the actual number when you interpolate between those two for $26,000 household income is actually a $2,013 premium cost. So he would pick buying the subsidized coverage on the exchange because that's going to cost him less than the $2,500 employee-only premium cost to buy the coverage through the employer.
Okay, so Charlie qualifies for both. Now, the next example, Donna, works for the same company. She also has single coverage, and she makes $1,000 more than Charlie. Does that change anything?
It does, because the premium, that $2,500 premium as a percentage of her household income, dropped to 9.26%. So she's not over that magic 9.5% threshold, so she's not going to be eligible for a subsidy. She's only going to be eligible for the voucher because, again, her household income's under 400% of the federal poverty level, and it's between 8% and 9.8% for the cost of the coverage as a percentage of her household income. So she's going to be eligible for the voucher.
Okay, then. Our last single person who works for Average Company, Ellen Edge, on slide 16, she has slightly higher income than Donna. What's her situation?
Ellen, unfortunately, isn't going to be eligible for anything because the premium costs less than 8% of her household income. Even though her income is in that magic band between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty level, she's not going to be eligible for either a voucher or a subsidy. Now, note that if the plan wasn't available, or if the employer's plan paid less than 60% of the total cost of benefits, Ellen would have qualified for a subsidy to buy subsidized coverage on the exchange. So this is the employee group who will be unhappy with having this coverage available to them because it means that they're not eligible to buy subsidized coverage on the exchange.
Okay, our sixth case study on slide number 17 is an employee and our only employee of low employee cost company. It's Lori. She has single coverage, and she has household income of $11,000, so it's similar to what Brian made. What's her situation?
You're right that her household income and family size is exactly the same as Brian, but unlike Brian, she's going to be eligible for a voucher instead of a subsidy because the lower premium as a percentage of her household income changed from 22.73% of household income, which was Brian's percentage, to only 9.09%, and so she's going to be less than the 9.5, so she's not going to be eligible for a subsidy. And she's between the 8 and 9.8, so she's going to be eligible for the voucher.
Now, our next three examples are all, they're going to be our last three single employees, and they all work for high employee cost company. Our first is Fred Fields. He has household income of $11,000, which is identical to Lori and to Brian. What is his situation, Jen?
Because his high-cost premium substantially exceeds the 9.5% of his household income, he will be eligible for a subsidy.
Okay, then let's change it up slightly. Let's go to example number 8. Greg works for the same company. He's single. His income is $20,000, so it's $9,000, almost twice as much as Fred. What's his situation?
Greg is going to be basically in the exact same position as Fred. The premium as a percentage of his household income has dropped from the 45% down to 25% of his household income, but it still exceeds 9.5% of household income. His compensation is still within that 100 to 400% band, so he's still going to be eligible for the subsidy.
Now, our last single employee is by far my favorite name, Helga Hill. She's single, works for high employee cost company, but makes more than twice as much as Fred and Greg. How's the law impact her?
Well, from an impact perspective, she's actually exactly the same as Fred and Greg in that she's going to be eligible for a subsidy. One of the things that's interesting to note here is she's basically got the highest compensation threshold you can have to still be within that less than 400% of the federal poverty level, and the premium as a percentage of her household income is 11.54%. She can't get under the 9.8% for the premium as a percentage of her household income to become eligible for a voucher. Now, this doesn't mean that if you charge a high enough premium, you can never be eligible for a voucher because someone could decide to enroll in single coverage but have more individuals in their family. And we'll show you how that impacts the analysis. But it will substantially reduce the population that could be eligible to get a voucher.
Well, let's move this to some family people. We've covered everybody so far has had single coverage. Example number 10, Isabella, has a family or household of four, looks for family coverage, and has income or household income of $20,000. What's her situation?
Well, Isabella has the same household income and total premium cost as Greg, our eighth example, who is on slide 19. But she isn't eligible for a subsidy or a voucher because her household income is less than 100% of the federal poverty level. She would still be eligible for Medicaid, and this actually has the same result whether she's at average company enrolling in family coverage or at high cost the high employee cost company enrolling for single coverage where there are more household members.
Now, our next example on slide 22, Jessica, she also works for Average Company. She also has family coverage, also a family of four, but she makes more than twice as much as Isabella. Is that going to change anything?
Well, the short answer is yes, it does change something. Jessica has the same income and premium cost as Helga, our ninth example on slide 20, and she has the same result as Helga. She's subsidy eligible. But you'll notice that the premium as a percentage and the premium as a percentage of her pay is exactly the same, that 11.54%. But now she is squarely within that 100 to 400% of the federal poverty level. She's not right at $1 shy of that threshold.
Now, our 12th example, Chris King on slide 23, again, works for Average Company, family coverage, four-person household, substantially higher income at $62,500. What's Chris's situation?
Well, Chris shows us that an individual paying the $5,000 premium for the expensive single coverage, just like Helga, or the average family coverage, like Jessica, can qualify for a voucher instead of a subsidy if the household income and number of family members is higher. So at a four-person household, the premium as a percentage of his household income is 8% in Chris's example. So Chris is going to be eligible for the voucher.
Now, just changing it up a little on slide 24, Mike also works for Average Company, also seeks family coverage, but only has a three-person household, an income of about $50,000. What is Mike's situation?
Well, Mike is going to be eligible for a subsidy, and really his situation is included here just to show that, you know, all of the examples we've given up to this point have been either a one-person household or a four-person household, and you know, you're going to have a wide variety of household sizes within your employee population, and really the thing that changes here is what your 100% and 400% of the federal poverty level number, the percentage of the premium to household income percentage doesn't change. So the only question really becomes, where do they fall within the band?
Now, our final example on slide 25, Nancy Nelson works for high employee cost company, gets family coverage, and has a substantially larger household with not quite reality TV level, but seven-person household, and higher income of $133,000. How's the law impact Nancy?
Well, Nancy shows us that even a person that has a six-figure household income can qualify for a voucher if there are enough people in their household. The premium as a percentage of her household income is 9.02%, so between that 8% and 9.8%. threshold, and her income is less than 400% of the federal poverty level for a household of seven members, and so Nancy is eligible for the voucher.
Thanks, Jen. If you look at slide 26, I think slide 26 does a good job of putting our people into the slots and how this whole process is going to work. If you see down at the bottom, Alan and Ellen and Isabella, they were eligible for neither voucher or subsidy. Charlie's our only person who's eligible for both, a subsidy and a voucher. And then you see where the others fall in within these bands that Jen was describing. So hopefully these examples have been helpful to show you how the interplay between the subsidies and the vouchers are going to work in 2014. Now, to bring things a little bit closer to current time, I'm going to turn over the program to my colleague Linda Mendel to walk through with you some of the communication issues that are going to impact you probably almost immediately. So, Linda?
Thanks, Tony. First, I want to point out that my colleagues have gone through the mathematical relationships of subsidies and vouchers, but there's also going to be a significant communication component. An individual is going to go to the exchange and inquire about purchasing insurance. This is going to be a web-based application. And somehow that exchange is going to need to reach out to you as an employer to get various data verifying employment and what you provide, your subsidy, et cetera. So it's possible that every single employer is going to have the capability of communicating with the exchange in every state where it has employees. We have absolutely no information about how that's going to be done, but I think it's going to be very difficult, at least initially, to get those communication lines going. So something to think about in the longer term. And then, as Tony said, I want to bring it back to what you're probably thinking about now, starting to plan now for your next plan year. So, again, many of the mandates we've talked about in the past teleconferences go into effect the first plan year starting after September 23, 2010, and for most of you, that's January 1, 2011. So you're starting to plan your communication issues. I wanted to bring it back down to legal basics, and, of course, many of you do way more than the minimum required by law, but just to see where your baseline is, and that's a summary plan description. A group health plan has to be described in a summary plan description, and there is a Department of Labor regulation that gives us about 40 items that have to go into a summary plan description, plus a myriad of other regulations from various agencies that talk about what we need to tell participants about the plan. So that's how we end up with some very long summary plan description. So when you change your health benefits, you have to either provide an updated summary plan description or an amendment of some kind. And our term for that is a summary of material modifications, an SMM. We love acronyms in the employee benefit field. So SMM is the technical term for here's what's changed about your benefit. We identify, you know, a list of changes as an amendment to the summary plan description so that we're not reprinting that 50 or 100-page document every single year. Well, where do you get this Big Sick document? If your plan is insured, you're getting a certificate from your insurance company, and that often includes most of the items that goes into a summary plan description. Sometimes there are some glaring omissions, omissions that cause confusion and problems, but the bulk of it will be in that certificate. And some people choose to take that certificate and do sort of an add-on to provide information on the missing item. If your plan is self-insured, you're probably getting some kind of template document from your third-party administrator. And the point I wanted to make about that is, regardless of the funding, whether you're insured or self-insured, from a legal standpoint, the plan sponsor is responsible to make sure the summary plan description and all the amendments are complete and correct. So who do you have to provide this summary plan description and your SMMs to? Obviously, employees enrolled in the plan, sometimes people forget, but it also has to go to, say, COBRA beneficiaries and retirees, if you have retirees covered, and even if you've got children covered pursuant to a medical child support order, it should go to the custodial parent. The point I wanted to highlight is the timing of the distribution of these SMMs, or notices of changes. Before healthcare reform, there was actually a rule on the books that if you reduce benefits, you had to provide an SMM within 60 days after the reduction. Well, I mean, I think we all know that doesn't seem particularly fair that you could cut back benefits and not tell people for 60 days because they could incur expenses that they reasonably would have expected are covered, and they're not. So, of course, the courts have not enforced that rule, and most courts will say a reduction doesn't go into effect until you communicate it to participants. So that's how we've been operating in the pre-healthcare reform world. Now, healthcare reform is mandating, on top of our summary plan description requirement, there's going to be a new four-page summary that we have to pass out. It doesn't take away the SPD requirement. It just adds this new four-page summary. And one of the things healthcare reform says about that four-page summary is that we have to give 60 days advance notice to the four-page summary, or advance notice of any changes to any of the information in this summary, as any changes, up or down. The way it's worded in the law is ambiguous. It could be construed to mean we have to give 60 days advance notice now of any change. Or it could mean that we have to give 60 days advance notice when these four-page summaries go into effect, which isn't going to be for a couple of years. So we're sort of in no man's land until we hear. Obviously, nobody's going to fight with you if you improve benefits and you don't tell them in advance, but it's very much an issue to be concerned about when you do reductions. So with that in mind, people are gearing up for their 2011 open enrollment materials, and I just wanted to quickly run through some items to think about, not that you need to do all of these, but just items to consider as you put together those materials, and I'm going to do this rather quickly so we have time for Q&A. So moving to slide 31. Checklist of communication issues. Of course, the big one that we've talked about in both our prior teleseminars are eligibility of adult children. And, of course, this is going to not just impact children over your current cutoff, whether that's 23 or 22 or 18, whatever it is. There's going to be a whole change in how you define children because you're going to have to remove financial dependency requirements, marital status requirements, student status requirements, so that you're going to have a new definition and you're going to have to communicate that definition and give people an opportunity to enroll. So it's going to have to be a minimum of 30 days. If your normal open enrollment period is less than 30 days, you're going to need to revisit that decision. Number two, if you have a lifetime dollar limit in your plan, that's going to go away. And that'll be another issue that you'll want to communicate for the fall. Number three, elimination of certain annual dollar limits. Here, this one, we're definitely going to need guidance on this because, of course, most plans have a number of dollar limits on chiropractic or infertility, and it's hard to believe that that is the type of thing we have to take out because the prohibition is going to be on certain annual limits on essential benefits, and I'm not sure whether those would be considered to be essential, but it's going to be whatever the government tells us. So we're watching for guidance, and that's on your checklist for communication. Elimination of pre-existing condition limitations on children under the age of 19. If you've got a pre-existing condition limitation in your plan right now, obviously you have to take it out for children under age 19, and you may just choose to take it out entirely because you're going to have to in 2014 anyway. So it's time to revisit that issue and think what you want to do and communicate it in the fall. Number five, last year we had to comply with the mental health parity law, and then in February of this year we got very detailed and in some ways very surprising regulations. So many of you are now having to look again at your mental health benefits and do some additional changes. So that, again, is something to be on your communication checklist. Number six, if you have a flexible spending account, a very important change that participants need to know about in planning their contribution for next year is that they can no longer use their FSA for over-the-counter medicines other than insulin. What's interesting about this is that it's still okay to use the FSA for over-the-counter supplies, so Band-Aids. But you probably want to get with your claims administrator, your FSA claims administrator, to find out from a substantiation standpoint, if you're using debit cards, is that something even doable? Can your FSA administrator distinguish between over-the-counter supplies and over-the-counter medicines? And you may just have to eliminate all over-the-counter items because of the substantiation issue. You may also want to mention in your communication that there's going to be a $2,500 cap on FSA contributions in 2013. That's not now, but I think it's been out there discussed, so some people might be confused, although I don't think many people contribute in that realm, but it's just something to think about. Number seven, it's very possible that you are contemplating other changes, benefit reductions, to sort of offset the cost increases associated with some of the new mandatory increases. So all of those reductions need to be communicated. Think about, number eight, think about whether you want to give a message about the longer term in terms of this is just one step in what is going to be a series of changes. You maybe haven't formulated your plans, but 2011 is probably not the last word in health plan changes. Number nine, next year there's going to be the W-2 reporting of health plan coverage cost. You may want to reassure people that that is informational only. They are not being taxed on their coverage. If you are going to participate in the CLASS Act, that long-term care program, the government-run long-term care program, there's going to be auto-enrollment for that, so you will definitely need to tell people about that. You will have the opportunity to opt out, so and I think many companies will be opting out. So if you're going to be in it, when we get guidance, you're definitely going to want to include something in your materials about how to opt out. Moving on to slide 33, the Healthcare Reform Act changes are going to impact some of the notices you normally give in open enrollment, specifically your notice of special enrollment rights. There's going to be special enrollment for families with adult dependents or other dependents who are newly eligible. Secondly, there's a general notice of pre-existing condition exclusion, which people use government language, and you're going to have to revisit that for the children under the age of 19. I've also listed on slide 33 other notices that typically go out with open enrollment. Just let me mention that the model CHIP notice is new this year, so if you haven't done that before, remember to include it. It doesn't apply. Right now, Ohio is one of the very few states that doesn't have premium assistance for Medicaid and CHIP eligible families, but if you have employees in other states, you will need to give that notice, and I have the website there so you can get more information about that if you haven't been thinking about that for a while. And with that, we are going to stop the recording, and the operator is